and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
President Trump had a campaign rally in North Carolina yesterday, basking in chants of "send her back." Those chants were directed at Minnesota Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She's a Somali refugee. She is a United States citizen. Trump now says he is not happy about those chants.
I was not happy with it. I disagree with it. But again, I didn't say that. They did.
That was today. But at the rally last night, he appeared satisfied with the chants. Earlier this week, of course, he tweeted the same thing about Omar and the rest of the so-called squad. Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, Massachusetts' Ayanna Pressley, and New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Well, polling shows the majority of Americans who knew about those tweets thought they were offensive. But Trump appears to see some political edge in playing up race heading into 2020. It plays well with his base. Here to talk about that and Trump's larger campaign strategy is James Homan. He's national political correspondent at The Washington Post. Welcome back.
Good to be with you, Madeline.
Well, you wrote that the rally really showed that these chants were a feature and not a bug of the Trump campaign and its strategy. How so? How is this planned?
You know, this isn't some gaffe. It was funny. I was up on Capitol Hill earlier this week, and John Cornyn, who's one of the top Senate Republicans, said, you know, this was really an unforced error. The president misspoke. But that's just not the case. You know, this has been a defining feature of his entire time in public life. Remember, it was in 2015 that Trump called for a complete and total ban on all Muslims entering the United States. And, you know, everyone kind of criticized him at the time, but his poll numbers among Republican primary voters went up. And, you know, Trump looks at the vote of disapproval in the House on Monday night, and he has said explicitly that he's emboldened by it, that he feels like it's a vote of confidence, that it's a validation of him making these offensive statements. And so this is kind of a recurring theme of his presidency. He has made the Republican Party much more oriented toward identity politics.
Right. And just that very phrase, send her back, sounds like lock her up.
But it's worse. You know, lock her up is bad because you're talking about locking up your political opponents. But, you know, this does. It's catchy. You know, the president today at the White House a couple hours ago said, you know, I disapprove of that. And he's reacting to, I think, pressure from some Republicans. But if you watch what Trump said this morning was, I tried to quickly move on and change the subject. But when you watch the tape, the president smiled and nodded and pointed, and he kind of basked in the chance of send her back for 14 seconds. You know, it was something the president clearly approved of. And it's also, you know, the message he's been espousing on Twitter for days now, which is go home. And so, you know, I think the president tries to have it both ways a lot of times. He's trying to signal to his audience. But the crowd loved it. They were into it. They were cheering. You know, and it's really quite something to watch the little kids in the crowd that are seeing their parents and their elders saying those kinds of statements and then, you know, chanting the same thing. And that says a lot, I think, about, you know, the president of the United States, no matter who it is, for better and worse, has the ability to move public opinion. After September 11th, George W. Bush told Americans not to lash out at Muslims for the terrorist attacks. That made a difference, and he's received credit for that, whether you like him or not on other things. And I think Trump is changing the Republican Party, and the polls show it, to become more like this, to become a much more racialized party.
How is it tracking amongst his potential voting base and amongst his potential supporters, even the ones who are kind of on the fence, or they were on the fence in 2016, held their noses and voted for him anyway?
Yes, I think the core Trump people, you know, Kris Kobach, the former Kansas Secretary of State, who's running for Senate, was asked on television the other night, if Trump said explicitly, I am a racist, would you still support him? And he said, well, it depends on who the Democrats put up. So those people are going to be with Trump no matter what. They're the dead enders. And so your question is a super important one, and the jury is still out. You know, there are a lot of independent suburban women who voted for Trump in 2016, voted for Democrats, in many ways delivered the House to Democrats in 2018. And what they do in 2020 remains to be seen. From Trump's perspective, he's gotten away with so much for so long from so many people, and he feels like, you know, there's less of a backlash each time that the Republican Party is his, that 90% of Republicans approve of him. Now, the president has not done anything to expand his base. Everything he's doing is about getting the people who voted for him in 2016 to vote for him again. He's not doing anything to appeal to new voters. And ultimately, I think that there is some method to the madness. There is some strategy behind it. I do think the president thinks it's politically good for him to elevate these four liberal minority congresswomen. But just because there's a strategy doesn't mean that it's a good strategy. And I think ultimately this just sort of makes him a more divisive figure, makes him a more polarizing figure. And I think the president likes having these fights. I think he actually enjoys, he relishes it. Mm-hmm. But it means that he's not talking about the good economy and, you know, the issues that his aides would like to be talking about. But this is what he's comfortable with. He's responding to watching a lot of conservative media. Conservative media has sort of been demagoguing these four women, especially Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar, for several months. And so I think he thinks this is fertile ground to till.
So when you say this may not be good strategy, there are two ways of reading that. There's good strategy in terms of good for the country, good for the body politic, good for everything else. And then just there's good for reelection. There's just, you know, there's that, the realpolitik of it all. When you say that, do you mean the former, the latter, or both?
I really appreciate you making that clarification, because you're right. In Washington, I mean the latter. I mean, this is political. This is pure politics. This is how it is, from Donald Trump's perspective, he stay in office and win four more years. This certainly is not good for the country. And, you know, to have, they say very objectively, this kind of divisive rhetoric, you know, is really tearing people apart. And it's, you know, there was a report yesterday about a big rise in online bullying since 2016. And the study doesn't mention the president, but again, the president has the ability to really set the tone for the country. And when the president of the United States is telling minorities, you know, three of the four born in this country, American citizens, to, you know, go home or to go back to where they came from, of course that's going to have an impact down the line, and you know, kids at schools and you know, people around the country yelling at immigrants in parking lots. So I think very objectively, this is terrible for the country as a nation. But politically, the strategy of getting reelected, I really do believe, and I know this from reporting and talking to inside sources at the White House, the administration believes, you know, that there are people inside the White House who think that this sort of works to Trump's advantage, that if he's talking about, you know, making Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez the face of the Democratic Party, that makes it easier for him to have Democrats as a foil. Because ultimately, in a lot of ways, Trump believes that his path to victory next year requires the election to be a choice between him, you know, who's flawed, and he'll say, I'm flawed, and a Democratic alternative. And if he can make people think that the Democratic alternative is Ilhan Omar, he thinks that he's more likely to win. There was a poll that came out overnight that shows that, you know, these four congresswomen are much more unpopular, especially among Republicans, and, you know, kind of their unfavorable numbers are much higher than even Nancy Pelosi, who's sort of been the, you know, the bete noire of conservatives for so many years, and that they are more disliked among kind of target Republican voters and people who supported the president in 2016 than any of the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates, including someone like Bernie Sanders. And so the White House is looking at those polls. Trump's getting daily polling updates at this point. And the president believes that, you know, if he can elevate these women, who they call themselves the squad, that if he can make them the face of the Democratic Party, that a lot of people who may have doubts about him, who may be uncomfortable with him, that they'll sort of vote for him over voting for, you know, frankly, we can say what it is, a Muslim American, you know, Somali refugee from Minnesota.
But that's James, eventually he's going to have to face a Democratic nominee who's going to be none of those women. So I guess the problem or the conundrum the Democrats have is, how closely do you embrace these four women if you want to be the Democratic nominee?
Well, and so what Trump thinks, it's a great question. What Trump thinks is that he set a trap, that he's been so provocative and so over the top that he sort of forced every Democrat to embrace these women and to call them sisters and to praise them and to vote for this resolution and to basically, as he sees it, endorse them. And what every Democrat would on Capitol Hill would respond and say is, we're not endorsing their ideas or some of their past statements, we're condemning the president's racist tweets. And that's the distinction that they would draw. But the president kind of thinks in kind of very binary terms. And so it's a challenge for Democrats because, frankly, you know, the presidential candidates, the Democratic presidential candidates, don't want to be talking all the time about, you know, Ilhan Omar. They want to be talking about their health care plans. But it's a challenge because, you know, and we lived through this in 2016. And, you know, Hillary Clinton spent all her time responding to provocative things Trump had said and struggled to kind of lay out a proactive, positive case for how she would make the country better. Or, you know, she would say that she did make that case, but no one was paying attention because mm-hmm. we were spending all our time paying attention to Trump. So right. This is a needle they're going to have to thread. Democrats can't just spend all their time reacting to the president.
James Holman, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, what Elon Musk wants to do with our brains. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Jonas Brothers are doing it. Drake is doing it. Seems like everyone is doing it. Downloading FaceApp, the app that shows what you look like when you're old or how you would look younger. All you have to do is upload a photo of yourself. It is not that simple, of course, because now there are worries the Russian company that owns FaceApp may have access to all sorts of your data. Here to tell us what exactly you're giving away when you upload your face is April Glazer. She writes about tech for Slate. Welcome back, April.
Thanks for having me.
Well, okay, so you uploaded a photo of yourself. It seems pretty benign. And then you get this fun little game. What is the dark side?
Well, we don't know. As with any app that you download on your phone and then you give your data to that app could then be sold. And then who knows what they're going to do with it. But for right now, it appears that FaceApp, which, yes, is based in Russia, although I don't know if that's any worse than an American company that does stuff with their data that we don't know about, is just taking that photo. It's not accessing your whole camera roll. It doesn't appear to be accessing your location. But it's all quite murky. I mean, even when we look in the terms of service policies, it does appear that you agree to let the company do whatever it might want to do in the future with the data that you offer it. And that is a picture of your face.
Although they did respond to these allegations with a statement that they gave to TechCrunch, and they said most images are deleted from our servers within 48 hours from the upload date. So.
Yeah, that's not in the contract. That's what they said. And, you know, they could be doing that now. Who knows what they'll be doing later. But that's what they're saying. And it appears, you know, according to what the CEO has provided to various news outlets, that it is benign. But the thing is that we just don't know what happens with our data once it is let out. It can be this company can be sold. It can be compelled by subpoena of various foreign governments or the U.S. government. And it is an app that's sitting on your phone. And we do know that apps tend to be pretty porous and sometimes collect more than we necessarily thought they were going to. But right now it does just appear to be taking that one photo.
Right. Because people were afraid that it was scooping up your entire photo library.
Yeah, now that doesn't appear to be happening. Researchers who have looked into the app say it's not looking at your whole camera roll. It's not looking at your whole photo library. You're not becoming some big training data set on all the photos of the, you know, 700 pictures of one sunset you took in one evening. Isn't going anywhere. It seems like it's just the picture, your picture. But that's what the terms of service say now. Those terms of service could change. You could click on agreeing to it again without thinking. And, you know, if we don't read those terms of service, we just don't know. But right now it does appear to be benign. We just don't know what's going to happen in the future.
So Chuck Schumer is calling for some kind of investigation. The DNC is warning people not in the, you know, candidates not to use FaceApp. It seems like there's some concern in Washington. Is there anything that they can actually do about this?
Well, it does make sense that, you know, candidates and campaigns, you know, might have some concern about downloading an app that is giving data to a company that's in an authoritarian regime. You know, we do know that, for instance, the DNC was hacked after somebody opened an email attachment, mm-hmm. right? And these things happen quite easily. And having an app on your phone from a country that where the government can compel more data to you know, that data to be handed over, or, you know, who knows what could happen, does seem like an understandable kind of threat model for people working at the level of a political campaign. If you're not at that level, then this really just seems kind of a scare that you don't need to engage with.
Right. Okay. So it seems that, well, we heard about this with Cambridge Analytica, speaking of the last election. When we were taking quizzes on Facebook, we were, you know, we didn't know what was happening with our data and our friends lists and all that kind of stuff. So,
and that's the thing is that we agreed at that point, we didn't agree to have our friends' data taken. And so just because we agree to something doesn't mean that that's what's going to happen.
Right. But why haven't we learned our lesson? Why are we doing this all over again?
Well, this does appear to be a fun app. People are enjoying it. You know, I mean, it's kind of amusing to see what you're going to look like in a, you know, few years down the road. Remember, this is the same app that popped up and went viral in 2017 when it offered filters for people to change their race. It offered a way for people to lighten their skin. It offered a black face, an Asian filter. And that was really offensive and kind of caused an uproar. This was in 2017. So this isn't the first time this app has gone viral for offering ways for us to change the way we look or kind of model how that may look in the future with its AI technology. And so, yeah, this is not the first time I've seen this app, but this is the first time we've seen this app after all the concern came out over Russian interference with the election.
Right. Well, you know, obviously, as you were saying earlier, this isn't the only company that's mining our data, and we are pretty well aware of that. And it seems that most people kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, you know, I'm not doing anything bad anyway, or I know that all of my photos are up in the cloud anyway. So what's the harm?
Right. Well, you know, it's hard to say what the harm is now. I mean, the it's an understandable reaction that, you know, this doesn't seem to be hurting me now, but we just don't know how problems can arise in the future, especially as we move into a more kind of biometric authentication space, right? So the more we are asked to use our face to open applications, or the more that face recognition is used by police departments, you know, this data could be used to train models that are used to identify us on the street or in footage. And it could be used to misidentify someone, too, because we do know that facial recognition systems just don't work as well for people of color. And you know, it could misidentify people. I mean, we just don't know how this data could be used in the future. And so it really makes sense to not, you know, want some random company training its AI system with your face. I think it's a totally understandable concern.
Did you do it yourself, April?
I have not done it, but I've seen my friends do it, and I, you know, smirked. But this is something I chose not to do, and it's because I also am a journalist, and I report often on kind of hate groups or you know, fringe right groups that have attempted to find my address or have attempted to go after me in many ways online because of my reporting. And I take, you know, very careful steps to make sure that my address is not available online. And, you know, and this is something that I have to do every month. I have to get my information scrubbed from data brokers because it repopulates because, you know, our information does kind of smear across the web all the time, whether or not we intend it to. And so you have to think about, you know, who knows how somebody might want to come after you in the future and what data you're letting out there.
April Glazer, she writes about technology for Slate. Thanks, April.
Thanks.
Coming up, want to live to be 180 years old? It's going to cost you.
Start you off at a counter that looks a lot like a spa. You're in a hotel, this luxury, beautiful property, the Beverly Hilton, and you walk in gleaming white. You sign a long, long waiver saying that things might happen, but you're okay with it.
Biohack your health at a high-tech gym, plus Elon Musk wants to hack your brain. Wow, so much hacking on the show today. Coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Imagine Siri knowing exactly what you're thinking. You don't have to ask her out loud. She just knows. Elon Musk is developing this technology, implants that can read brain activity and then send it to a machine which can translate it. His company, Neuralink, is testing this out on animals. The goal is to help people with paralysis or with Parkinson's. Maybe one day it'll be so safe and commonplace that even healthy people we'll do it. Ashley Vance read about Musk's plan for Bloomberg Business Week. He's also the author of a biography of Elon Musk. It's called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Hi.
Hi.
Well, this would surely be a fantastic future, or maybe not. Maybe it's just a dystopic, horrific future. But explain to me exactly what this device is and what it would do.
Yeah, it is a few companies and researchers that have been on this quest for quite some time to build what they call a brain-machine interface. And so this would potentially be a link between computers and humans in which you could hopefully one day exchange information both ways. And for the moment, the way Neuralink is approaching this is by putting what are essentially these long wires that they call threads full of electrodes and inserting them into your brain and then having that those systems communicate with a computer.
And what could go wrong? Besides a million things.
I mean, you know, this technology has, you know, it's been used already in some forms, right? You have people that have lost their visions or in the case of Parkinson's, they're using similar technology to stimulate parts of your brain. And so there are tons of therapeutic uses for this kind of stuff that's very encouraging, where especially somebody who's paralyzed could then use a computer just by thinking words or thinking where they want the cursor to go. It gets much more philosophical and scary as you move on, because the ultimate vision for this really is to create some sort of like a cyborg where you're part human and part computer. And so, you know, on the upside, you could learn a language instantly or keep up with artificial intelligence. On the downside, potentially, you know, the human race would be altered forever.
Right, because you're saying that it could send information to you. You wouldn't just be downloading information to it.
Yeah, that is absolutely the goal of Neuralink. So they want this to be a bidirectional sort of thing where you could essentially download information from a computer, and then on the other way, the computer would know what you're thinking, when you're telling the truth, how you really feel about something, and have insight into that information. You could also see a scenario where, you know, this is the total sci-fi thing where you're reading somebody else's thoughts, or you create this brain-to-brain connection where you don't even have to speak. Maybe we can express things like empathy in a totally new way to each other.
And then maybe also get hacked.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, Elon's one of these guys who's really afraid of artificial intelligence. And at the moment, we do at least have some sort of barrier between us and the machines. Once you put a computer into your head, that goes away. And so if AI did run amok, like Elon was saying, then we've sort of set ourselves up, right, to be taken over by the machines. And then obviously, Elon, Neuralink, in this presentation they gave earlier this week, were saying, you'll essentially tap into these things on an app off your iPhone, and so you could definitely see a situation where some hacker gets control of this and starts messing with your brain implant.
Oh my gosh. Well, all of this sounds like excellent fodder for Black Mirror or for any number of science fiction books or TV shows or movies or what have you. But how real is this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, after seeing Neuralink's presentation and going to their office, I mean, I think basically what they have done is taken science that has been in research labs, that has been used in only the most extreme cases of in hospitals for somebody that really has no other option, is willing to have a brain surgery, and have what are today much larger devices. So the type of device today that gets plugged into your head is about the size of a human fist, and it has these very rigid needles that go in. And, you know, this is something you only do in extreme cases. What Neuralink has done is used robotics and materials advances to shrink all of that way down into a device that's about, that's smaller than a penny, and to put that into your skull. And so this is very real in a lot of ways. I mean, this stuff exists. They've improved upon it. They're putting it in rats and in primates. You know, as far as when a human does this therapeutically, they have to answer huge questions with the FDA. And then as far as when a consumer would just sign up for this surgery and go in for an hour and have us done, I mean, you know, I think we're talking many, many years away, if ever.
And yet, isn't he trying to apply for human trials soon?
So they do want to do human trials by the end of next year. As always, Elon's timelines are very optimistic. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a case that if their technology works as billed so far, it should work in a human. But then you also have to prove, not only you have to prove that this can sit inside of a brain for a long period of time, and also that it is delivering a therapeutic use. And so that part is not clear either. The Neuralink guys are optimistic about the FDA trials, and they're also optimistic about where this is heading. So the procedure that they see coming for consumers, they say it will be like a LASIK eye surgery. You'll go in for an hour. You won't even be under general anesthetic. You would just have local anesthetic, and they would put these probes in your brain, and off you go.
And off you go. Could you get it removed if you didn't like it anymore?
That part, you certainly could get it removed. It's unclear. You know, every time you do this, there is damage to the veins in your brain and the brain tissue. And I don't think anybody really knows at this point what, you know, in an ideal world, you would just want to be messing around with this as little as possible. But you know, it's essentially like a microchip with wires dangling down from it that they're putting in these holes that they drill in your skull. And so, you know, you could yank it out if you need to.
But seriously, when you think of an aging population and you think of dementia and Alzheimer's and other brain diseases, I could see a lot of people saying, okay, let's try this because nothing else has helped. And we're at epidemic level proportions for these brain diseases.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, like, it's fun to speculate about all the sci-fi stuff and everything and which way it could go. But the very real scenario here is that we need advances in this area. I mean, this type of technology could be amazing for a lot of people. And what I've seen covering this space is that university labs tend not to have as much money as you would need to develop new devices in this area. At the same time, the science has gotten really exciting and we've learned a lot more, and people are actually able to provide therapies already. And so, you know, the twist here that I find encouraging is that you have this guy who has a ton of money, who's put $160 million into this project and sort of turbocharged all of the science and the underlying machines. And, you know, as far as this being like a therapeutic use, I think people should only be encouraged.
So as you said earlier, he's really afraid of the machines taking over. Why is he doing this then?
You know, if you take him at his word, during the presentation that he gave in San Francisco, he basically said, look, AI is going to improve dramatically, and it's going to go, you know, maybe three different ways. It's either going to be benign, neutral, or evil. And in any of these cases, you may want the humans to be able to keep up with the machines. And this is the way we would be able to keep up with them. And so he presented it as, you know, some humans will elect to do this type of thing, and some might not. And that's just that it's a decision people are going to make. But that if you want to have humans keep their jobs in the face of AI, or just to sort of have control in a world where AI is the dominant intelligence, this might be the only way to do that.
So basically he's saying we are helpless in the face of this onslaught. Let's at least try to get rest a modicum of control before they completely overwhelm us.
I mean, it gives you options, right? But Elon's not alone in this thinking. There's another brain startup in Los Angeles called Kernel that's run by a man named Brian Johnson, who made a bunch of money in the technology space. And so he's trying to build a device that you wouldn't have to surgically implant, that could be outside of the body. But, you know, he thinks very much in the same way that AI is going to get us here sooner or later and be the dominant force and sort of subjugate humans to its will, and that this is our way to keep up. And so this is not there's a lot of people thinking this way right now.
Wow. Ashley Vance, he wrote about Elon Musk and Neuralink for Bloomberg Business Week this week. And also he wrote a book about Elon called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, that's Hacking Your Brain. Now, your body.
Once again, I am Hans.
And I am Franz. And we are here to pop your...
Want to live to be 180? Well, it turns out you don't have to pump you up. You can join a bulletproof gym called an Upgrade Lab. The caffeinated brain behind all this is Dave Asprey. He's the guy who founded Bulletproof Coffee. He's got all sorts of plans to biohack his way to immortality. Natalie Compton wrote about him and his new gym for Wired, and she's here now. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
What is biohacking really?
So biohacking is a way to change your body by using your biology to make you the most upgraded version of yourself. So you learn things from science, and then you apply that to your body in an attempt to live until you're 180, if you're Dave Asprey. But it's a fascinating world to learn about if you are like me and went to the biohacking conference that took place earlier this year.
Well, tell us more about him. So did you talk to him there?
Yes. So I'd been familiar with Asprey because of Bulletproof Coffee. I think it's a popular enough phenomenon now that a lot of people may have tried butter in their coffee because of him. So I was familiar with him when I came across Upgrade Labs. And when I had the opportunity to go to the conference, I immediately jumped on it because I think it's a fascinating world. Asprey was there looking fit and glorious, and it was a really high, very high energy situation that I learned a lot from.
Yeah, because of all that coffee, lots of energy.
Yeah.
Well, talk a little bit about this Upgrade Lab. It's not called a gym.
No, yeah. So Upgrade Labs is different than a traditional gym because they want to back everything by data. So they tell you to come in and book a consultation, tell them what you want to do. Then they give you this free cell health analysis. Everything is very scientific compared to going to a 24-hour fitness and just signing up and lifting weights. So once you get there, you do this free cell health analysis, you get a personalized upgrade plan, and then you not only focus on fitness, but you work on recovery as well, using all of this very high-tech technology that Dave Asprey has looked at in his own personal quest of biohacking, and whatever he deemed most efficient, he brought to this new kind of gym.
So give me an example of what a workout would look like.
Yeah, so when I took a tour of the Upgrade Labs in Beverly Hills, they have two locations. They start you off at a counter that looks a lot like a spa. You're in a hotel, this luxury, beautiful property, the Beverly Hilton, and you walk in gleaming white. You sign a long, long waiver saying that things might happen, but you're okay with it. So then you go in I think because you're using all of these high-tech pieces of equipment, it said you're signing off in case of death. So I'm hoping that doesn't happen when you step into a cryotherapy chamber. Yeah. I think they're just covering all of their bases in case, just because this is all very new technology. But so you walk in, someone takes over to go and put you on some of these new devices like the Vasper Cold Hit. It's this machine that looks a lot like a seated elliptical, where you're moving both your legs and your arms while you're holding these cold pads. You have cold pads on your biceps, cold pads on your quads. The feet pedals are cooled as well. So you feel very cold. You're not sweating that much. I'm a very sweaty person, and when I tried it out, I wasn't sweating at all. But it's supposed to give you a workout that is much longer than the one that you're doing. So you might do a couple of the different workout machines that they have like that, these artificial intelligence bikes that give you the most efficient biking workout, and then move on to some of the recovery tools that they have, such as cryotherapy, or they have these Juve red light therapy beds that you lay in that look like a tanning bed, but it's not giving you harmful light. It's supposed to be giving you restorative light.
Wait, what's the light though?
It's red light therapy. So instead of having harmful rays of light, you're getting something that is said to be therapeutic and help your, what they say is that it helps with muscle recovery or your skin health.
Okay, that all sounds very nice, and maybe that works, but how will that make you live longer?
Asprey is saying if you hack all of these little things and your body is working in a more healthy way, you're not getting hurt as much, you're sleeping better, you're supposed to live longer.
And so all of that costs a fair amount of money, especially a gym in Beverly Hills.
Right. So right now, because Dave Asprey has said that he spent millions of his own dollars accumulating this technology, trying it himself, and now he's trying to bring it to more people. And the memberships are expensive to Upgrade Labs. Right now, it costs people about $1,000 a month to be a part of this community, and eventually they want to bring that cost down once they start opening new locations. But no, it's definitely a pricey endeavor at this time.
So are people doing it? Were there people in the gym?
People are doing it. When I took a tour, there were multiple people there. And then once you went to this biohacking conference, you saw how many people were either curious about the lifestyle or had this technology. Since I wrote the story, I've had people reach out and tell me, oh, I have a Juve red light machine, or, oh, I love cryotherapy, or yada yada. So it's definitely not isolated to Asprey alone.
Cryotherapy is when you sit in a really cold, like an ice room.
Essentially, yeah. You're stepping into a liquid nitrogen tank that is cooling your body down, and it's supposed to be good for recovery. But there have been things that might show otherwise that I talked about in the story. For example, icing might not be as effective as we thought with recovery. There's a book called Good to Go that's out now that goes into more detail about that. So I'm not exactly sure about cryotherapy personally, and people might need to take that one with a grain of salt.
It seems like a lot of it you need to take with a grain of salt, because there isn't a lot of science backing that up. The whole idea of bulletproof coffee, for example, making you smarter, that's been pretty much debunked, because there's no science to back that up. What of his biohacks has been supported by science?
I think when I was doing research into this story, I was so impressed by Wired's fact-checking process. Yeah, I couldn't just say, oh, I think this thing works. They really dug deep and found different articles to back things up. For example, we weren't sure about the Pulse Center's PEMF machines, and we're a little concerned about that one. But for example, meditation seems to be something that the scientific community has embraced as being beneficial for you, and Asprey is all about that.
Oh, meditation, yeah. And that's free. You can do that on your own.
That's free, and you can do it on your own, although they were selling devices at the conference that you do pay for, or you pay for services, subscription services, to learn how to meditate better.
Is there anything that you would try again? Any of these machines or any of these hacks that you thought, you know, this actually would and does improve my life?
I think the Vasper cold hit technology could be interesting, and maybe that would be helpful in a longer term. But how are you going to know if you just sample it at a conference?
That's the cold elliptical you're talking about, right?
Yes. I would love to have a way to work out for a short amount of time and get better results. So maybe I need $1,000 to do that.
Or
or accept my
run around the block
or go
meditate.
The old school way.
Do some jumping jacks and meditate.
Yes. I don't think that's the way that people in Los Angeles want to look at wellness these days. I think this is in line with our drive to hack workouts in general and hack our wellness.
Yeah. Natalie Compton, she covered biohacking for Wired magazine. Natalie, thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Coming up, film critic Alonzo Duralde is here to preview Outfest next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Outfest begins today with an opening gala at the Orpheum downtown. The film festival's main mission is to promote equality and to share more LGBTQ stories on the big screen. Alonzo Duralde is the senior programmer at Outfest. He's also one of our favorite film critics, of course, and I spoke with him earlier about his favorite films screening at the festival. So, Alonzo, this has grown substantially from how it began as a tiny little film festival in the 1980s on the UCLA campus. It's
yes.
now, what, to over 100 movies or more?
At least. I lose track at this point, but it's between features and shorts, there's a
bunch of them. And it's over the next 10 days.
Yes.
You have brought us four to highlight.
Yes, because, you know, I could be here all day.
You could be here all day. Okay, so let's begin with number one. This one's called Queering the Script. It's a documentary. What is this one about?
So this is a documentary about lesbian inclusion in primetime television, which has been, improving in recent years. Obviously, there's been a lot more integration of LGBT storylines in TV, but that has kind of come as a double-edged sword because there is also what is now popularly known as the hashtag bury your gays trope, which is we're going to introduce some queer characters and then we're going to kill them. And that happens a lot.
That is funny and not funny.
Yes, it's nuts, but that's where we are. So this is a documentary sort of, talking to different writers and actors and people involved in the industry about how that works and what we might do to make things better. We're very excited. There's going to be a panel after our screening. The director, Gabrielle Zilka, is going to be there, but also Amber Benson from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, mm-hmm. who was a hashtag barrier gay early on. Isabella Gomez from One Day at a Time. A lot of different people who are players in primetime TV who will have a lot to say on the subject.
Well, things have gotten more progressive, better, if you will, with Orange is the New Black, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, you can point to any number of shows that are out there right now that, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you would not be seeing them on the air. At the same time, however, I think we can still be kind of critical about mm-hmm. what kind of representation are we getting and how are these characters being treated.
Okay, when is that one airing?
That's going to be this Saturday the 20th at 4:30.
Queering the Script.
Yes.
Peer Kids. This is about homeless LGBTQ youth living on or near Christopher Street Pier in New York, mm-hmm. the famous pier in a famous area of New York for gay rights.
Yes.
Don't wake up and say, okay, mom, dad, aunt, uncle, I'm gonna go be homeless now. I'm gonna go just sit on the pier, sleep on the train, and that's what I'm gonna do.
This is one of our world premieres, as directed by Elegance Bratton, and there has been a lot of interest of late with, there was just the reissue of Paris is Burning. Pose on FX, obviously, is kind of showing a spotlight of drag ball culture from the late 80s, early 90s. And this is kind of like, here's what's happening today. This is what a lot of these queer youth are homeless, they are poor, they're living on the streets, but they are fabulous, and they are, expressing themselves and doing really great, just fascinating kind of art in their lives. And the movie focuses on a young trans woman named Crystal LaBeija, who is, she's named herself for kind of a ballroom legend. I was here not long ago talking about the documentary
yes.
The Queen, which we're also showing at Outfest and which will be opening in LA very soon. So this is the new Crystal LaBeija, and this is sort of the new generation of queer New York kids who are doing exciting things.
But Alonzo, you're making it sound like it's all fun and games and artsy fun as a homeless person living on the pier. No, it's obviously not.
And this movie is, you know, unflinching about the challenges there. But, you know, I think this is a celebration. This is about people, you know, in the same way that Paris is Burning was. You know, these are people who are being marginalized by society, who are on the outer edges and, you know, having to deal with a day-to-day existence, but who are also, you know, putting together these incredible sort of visual presentations.
Yeah. Okay. And this is screening when?
Sunday, July 21st at 4:15.
All right. Let's move on to The Stars. It is a drama, not a documentary. It's in black and white. Tell us about that one.
To the Stars was a big hit at Sundance this year, and we're thrilled to be bringing it to its first Los Angeles screening. It's set in Oklahoma in the 1960s, and it's about two girls who are both outsiders in this, you know, fairly rural community who become close. And you know, it's an Outfest film, so you can imagine how close. But it's beautifully shot and really moving, and has you know, the two leads are newcomers to the screen, but the supporting cast includes the likes of Malin Ackerman and Tony Hale, and so this is a film that I think has a real possibility of finding a wider audience, and we're thrilled to be part of that process.
So the story of two women falling in love in 1960s Oklahoma, I imagine that was not an easy time or place.
No, not in the slightest. they are high schoolers, so it's a coming-of-age movie, but it's also about how, you know, we have to sort of remind ourselves that, you know, for whatever progress that the LGBTQ community is making and will continue to make, it was very recently really, really terrible everywhere in this country, and some places more than others. And it still is, you know, I mean, this is a struggle that is not anywhere near over. But I think it's always important, especially as new younger generations keep coming up, that our history, you know, play a part in you know, people's lives and understanding where we've come from and what we've overcome.
Okay. And this one is when?
This one is two screenings, July 19th at 7 o'clock, and then July 20th at 9:15.
All right. That's called To the Stars. Finally, let's talk about Changing the Game, another documentary, and it follows three transgender high school athletes.
Would it be fair for me to be competing on the boys' team? No. I am a girl. That's who I am, no matter what.
I am a girl. I deserve to be on the girls' team.
All right. So they win their fight?
Well, this is a story of three different athletes, all dealing with sort of different, you know, you have this incredibly talented wrestler in Texas who is a trans man, but is forced by the state to wrestle as a girl. And has to, you know, is the girl state champion, but is clearly, you know, a guy. And then you have these other two athletes, Sarah Rose Huckman, who's a skier, and Andrea Yearwood, who's a track star. And they're in New England, and the policies are very different. And so, you know, in Connecticut, if you are a trans woman, then you will compete as a woman. They don't see any reason that they would treat you differently on the athletic field than they would, you know, in the rest of the school day. And so in all these places, there is pushback from people who don't think it's fair or who have some issue with it. But ultimately, it's about these three really talented athletes who want to be able to be athletes and become the best that they can at their given sport and also live their truth in, you know, the gender that they know that they are.
Well, that's so interesting because it raises a larger question of why we have separate girls and boys sports to begin with.
Sure. And I think these are topics that are going to be discussed and are going to go on being an issue. But you also see people in the film. There's a lot of Fox News clips in this movie where you can tell that it's not a good faith argument. It's just it's the new version of like ACK bathrooms, you know, it's ACK locker rooms or ACK, you know, unfair competition or whatever. But, you know, I think what it really does boil down to is that you just have these extraordinary athletes and they should be able to pursue the thing that they love and to be themselves while they do it.
Okay, when is that one showing?
That is our documentary centerpiece film, and that's going to be screening on Thursday, July 25th at 7 o'clock.
Changing the Game.
Yes.
It's only four movies. You're right. We could have spent all day talking about these.
Indeed. If you go to outfest.org, you can find our complete schedule. There is an astonishing array of films, from documentaries and narratives. There are films from around the world, short films, features, classics, works in progress, readings from the screenplay lab fellows from this year. They will have scenes from each of those scripts being acted out by actors you know. And it's such a vibrant meeting of the communities of the city, you know, as they interconnect from, you know, across cultures, across, you know, parts of the LGBTQ community, the filmmaking community. We've got screenings happening all over town, from the Orpheum and the Ace downtown to Plaza de la Raza, to the Ford Theaters, to the Music Hall. We're trying to encompass as much of LA as possible, both geographically and, you know, philosophically.
Okay. I think you did it.
Thank you.
Alonzo Duralde is senior programmer at Outfest, and the festival begins today. It ends Sunday, July 28th. Alonzo, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Michelle Alloy, what you got?
Got a lot of feedback from Marianne Williamson on your interview with her yesterday.
From her.
A lot of harnessed love.
From fans of hers.
A lot of... The opposite of harness love, too.
Really?
Yes. A little bit here, a little bit there. Jay Foster sent us a poem. If Jesus were alive today, he'd cheer for Marianne, because she's the one with the chutzpah to make love cool again. That's beautiful.
That is.
Jay Foster is harnessed love. Jenny says, thank you, KCRW Press Play, for having Marianne Williamson on your show. I'm a longtime listener and was so excited to hear this fresh voice on politics. Hashtag Marianne 2020, hashtag Big Truth. Kim D says, I enjoyed the interview. Over on Facebook, though, the sense was a little bit different. Ted Herman took some issue with comparing her to the Democratic version of Donald Trump. And let's see, Joey Kelly says, should have never put her on the show. She's a quack. So,
okay. Well, we are putting on, or trying to put on, all of the
all enemies. Of them.
Every last
every
one of them.
Every single
one
of them.
We're going to do it, too.
Chugging through.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle Alloy. I expect a poem to be written about you shortly. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.